walking again, and soon came to the Shmirna Kasin. Potted palms flanked a grand entrance, but the door stood wide open. He stepped inside. No one stopped him. There was no one around. He followed a red carpet to the second floor and into the gaming room. The craps table was unoccupied. Nobody was at the roulette wheel. In the far corner, however, a group of men were playing cards. They glanced up at Lefty, but then returned to their game, ignoring his dirty clothes. That was when he realized that the gamblers weren't regular club members. They were refugees, like him. Each had wandered through the open door in hopes of winning money to buy passage out of Shmirna. Lefty approached the table. A card player asked, "You in?" "I'm in." He didn't understand the rules. He'd never played poker before, only backgammon. And for the first half hour, he lost again and again. Eventually, though, Lefty began to understand the difference between five-card draw and seven-card stud, and gradually, the balance of payments around the table began to shift. "Three of these," Lefty said, showing three aces. And the men started to grumble. They watched his dealing more closely, mistaking his clumsiness for a card-sharp sleight of hand. Lefty began to enjoy himself, and after winning a big pot, cried, "Uzo, all around!" But when nothing happened, he looked up and saw again how truly deserted the casino was, and the sight brought home to him the high stakes they were playing for. Life. They were playing for their lives. And now, as he examined his fellow gamblers and saw perspiration beating their brows and smelled their sour breath, Lefty Stefanides, showing far more restraint than he would 4 decades later when he played the Detroit numbers, stood up and said, "I'm folding." They nearly killed him. Lefty's pockets bulged with winnings, and the men insisted he couldn't leave without giving them a chance to win some of it back. He bent over to scratch his leg, insisting, "I can go out any time I want." One of the men grabbed him by his soiled lapels, and Lefty added, "And I don't want to yet." He sat down, scratching his other leg, and thereafter started losing again and again. When all his money was gone, Lefty got up and said with disgusted anger, "Can I leave now?" The men said, "Sure, leave," laughing as they dealt the next hand. Lefty walked stiffly, dejectedly out of the casino. In the entrance, between the potted palms, he bent down to collect the money he'd stashed in his ripe-smelling socks. Back at the quay, he sought out Desdemona. "Look what I found," he said, flashing his money. "Somebody must have dropped it. Now we can get a ship." Desdemona screamed and hugged him. She kissed him right on the lips. Then she pulled back, blushing, and turned to the water. "Listen," she said. "Those British are playing music again." She was referring to the service band on the Iron Duke. Every night, as officers dined, the band began playing on the ship's deck. Strains of Vivaldi and Brahms floated out over the water. Over brandy, Major Arthur Maxwell of His Majesty's Marines and his subordinates passed around binoculars to observe the situation ashore.
"Jolly crowded, what?"
"Looks like Victoria Station on Christmas Eve, sir."
"Look at those poor wretches, left to fend for themselves. When word gets out about the Greek commissioners leaving, it's going to be pandemonium."
"Will we be evacuating refugees, sir?"
"Our orders are to protect British property and citizens.
But surely, sir, if the Turks arrive and there's a massacre..."
"Oh, there's nothing we can do about it, Phillips. I've spent years in the Near East. The one lesson I've learned is that there is nothing you can do with these people. Nothing at all. The Turks are the best of the lot. The Armenian I liken to the Jew, deficient moral and intellectual character. As for the Greeks, well, look at them. They've burned down the whole country, and now they swarm in here crying for help. Nice cigar, what?"
"Awfully good, sir. Shmirna tobacco, finest in the world. Brings a tear to my eyes, Phillips. The thought of all that tobacco lying in those warehouses out there.
Perhaps we could send in a detail to save the tobacco, sir."
"Do I detect a note of sarcasm, Phillips?"
"Faintly, sir, faintly."
"Good Lord, Phillips, I'm not heartless. I wish we could help these people, but we can't. It's not our war."
"Are you certain of that, sir?"
"What do you mean?"
"We might have supported the Greek forces, seeing as we sent them in."
"They were dying to be sent in. Venizelos and his bunch. I don't think you fathom the complexity of the situation. We have interests here in Turkey. We must proceed with the utmost care. We cannot let ourselves get caught up in these Byzantine struggles.
I see, sir.
More cognac, sir. Yes, thank you.
It's a beautiful city, though, isn't it?
Quite.
You are aware of what Strabo said of Smyrna, are you not?
He called Smyrna the finest city in Asia. That was back in the time of Augustus.
It lasted that long.
Take a good look, Phillips. Take a good long look.
By September 7th, 1922, every Greek in Smyrna, including Lefty Stefanides, is wearing a fez in order to pass as a Turk. The last Greek soldiers are being evacuated at Kesme. The Turkish army is only 30 miles away, and no ships arrive from Athens to evacuate the refugees. Lefty, newly moneyed and befezed, makes his way through the maroon-capped crowd at the quay. He crosses tram tracks and heads uphill. He finds a steamship office. Inside, a clerk is bending over passenger lists. Lefty takes out his winnings and says, "Two seats to Athens." The head remains down.
"Deck or cabin?"
"Deck."
1,500 drachmas.
"No, not cabin," Lefty says. "Deck will be fine."
"That is deck."
1,500? I don't have 1,500. It was 500 yesterday.
"That was yesterday."
On September 8th, 1922, General Hasianistis, in his cabin, sits up in bed, rubs first his right leg and then his left, wraps his knuckles against them, and stands up. He goes above deck, walking with great dignity, much as he will later proceed to his death in Athens when he is executed for losing the war. On the quay, the Greek civil governor, Aristides Stagiades, boards a launch to take him out of the city. The crowd hoots and jeers, shaking fists. General Hasianistis takes the scene in calmly. The crowd obscures the waterfront, his favorite café. All he can see is the marquee of the movie theater at which, 10 days earlier, he'd been to see Le Tango de l'Amour. Briefly, and possibly this is another hallucination, he smells the fresh jasmine of Bonabat. He breathes this in. The launch reaches the ship, and Stagiades' ashen face climbs aboard. And then General Hasianistis gives his only military order the past few weeks.
"Up anchors! Reverse engines! Full steam ahead!"
On shore, Lefty and Desdemona watch the Greek fleet leaving. The crowd surged toward the water, raised its 400,000 hands, and shouted. And then it fell silent. Not one mouth uttered a sound as the realization came home that their own country had deserted them, that Smyrna now had no government, that there was nothing between them and the advancing Turks. And did I mention how in summer the streets of Smyrna were lined with baskets of rose petals, and how everyone in the city could speak French, Italian, Greek, Turkish, English, and Dutch? And did I tell you about the famous figs? Brought in by camel caravan and dumped onto the ground, huge piles of pulpy fruit lying in the dirt, with dirty women steeping them in salt water and children squatting to defecate behind the clusters. Did I mention how the reek of the fig women mixed with pleasanter smells of almond trees, mimosa, laurel, and peach, and how everybody wore masks on Mardi Gras and had elaborate dinners on the decks of frigates? I want to mention these things because they all happened in that city that was no place exactly, that was part of no country, because it was all countries, and because now if you go there, you'll see modern high-rises, amnesiac boulevards, teeming sweatshops, a NATO headquarters, and a sign that says, Izmir. 5 cars, bedecked with olive branches, burst the city gates. Cavalry gallop fender to fender. The cars roar past the covered bazaar, through cheering throngs in the Turkish quarter, where every street lamp, door, and window streams red cloth. By Ottoman law, Turks must occupy a city's highest ground, so the convoy is high above the city now, heading down. Soon the 5 cars pass through the deserted sections where houses have been abandoned or where families hide. Anita Filipposian peeks out to see the beautiful leaf-covered vehicles approaching. The sight so arresting, she starts to unfasten the shutters before her mother pulls her away. And there are other faces pressed to slats, Armenian, Bulgarian, and Greek eyes peeking out of hideaways and attics to get a look at the conqueror and divine his intentions. But the cars move too fast, and the sun on the cavalry's raised sabers blinds the eyes. And then the cars are gone, reaching the quay, where horses charge into the crowd and refugees scream and scatter. In the back seat of the last car sits Mustafa Kemal. He is lean from battle. His blue eyes flash. He hasn't had a drink in over 2 weeks. The diverticulitis Dr. Filipovsin had treated the Pasha for was just a cover-up. Kemal, champion of westernization and the secular Turkish state, would remain true to those principles to the end, dying at 57 of cirrhosis of the liver. And as he passes, he turns and looks into the crowd as a young woman stands up from a suitcase. Blue eyes, pierce brown. 2 seconds. Not even two. Then Kemal looks away. The convoy is gone. And now it is all a matter of wind. 1 a.m. Wednesday, September 13th, 1922. Lefty and Desdemona have been in the city 7 nights now. The smell of jasmine has turned to kerosene. Around the Armenian quarter, barricades have been erected. Turkish troops block the exits from the quay. But the wind remains blowing in the wrong direction. Around midnight, however, it shifts. It begins blowing southwesterly, that is, away from the Turkish heights and toward the harbor. In the blackness, torches gather. 3 Turkish soldiers stand in a tailor shop. Their torches illuminate bolts of cloth and suits on hangers. Then as the light grows, the tailor himself becomes visible. He is sitting at his sewing machine, right shoe still on the foot treadle. The light grows brighter still to reveal his face, the gaping eye sockets, the beard torn out in bloody patches. All over the Armenian quarter, fires bloom. Like 1 million fireflies, sparks fly across the dark city, inseminating every place they land with a germ of fire. At his house on Suyani Street, Dr. Filipovsin hangs a wet carpet over the balcony, then hurries back inside the dark house and closes the shutters. But the blaze penetrates the room, lighting it up in stripes. Tuki's panicked eyes, Anita's forehead wrapped with a silver ribbon like Clara Bow's in photoplay, Rose's bare neck, Stepan's and Karikin's dark, downcast heads. By firelight, Dr. Filipovsin reads for the 5th time that night. He is respectfully recommended to the esteem, confidence, and protection. You hear that? Protection! Across the street, Mrs. Bitzikian sings the climactic 3 notes of the Queen of the Night aria from the magic flute. The music sounds so strange amid the other noises of doors crashing in, people screaming, girls crying out, that they all look up. Mrs. Bitzikian repeats the B-flat, D, and F 2 more times, as though practicing the aria. And then her voice hits a note none of them has ever heard before, and they realize that Mrs. Bitzikian hasn't been singing an aria at all. Rose, get my bag. Nishan, no, his wife objects. If they see you come out, they'll know we're hiding. No one will see. The flames first registered to Desdemona as lights on the ship's hulls. Orange brush strokes flickered above the waterline of the USS Litchfield and the French steamer Pierre Loti. Then the water brightened as though a school of phosphorescent fish had entered the harbor. Lefty's head rested on her shoulder. She checked to see if he was asleep. Lefty, Lefty. When he didn't respond, she kissed the top of his head. Then the sirens went off. She sees not one fire, but many. There are 20 orange dots on the hill above, and they have an unnatural persistence, these fires. As soon as the fire department puts out one blaze, another erupts somewhere else. They start in hay carts and trash bins. They follow kerosene trails down the center of streets. They turn corners. They enter bashed-in doorways. One fire penetrates Barbarian's bakery, making quick work of the bread racks and pastry carts. It burns through to the living quarters and climbs the front staircase, where halfway up it meets Charles Barbarian himself, tries to smother it with a blanket, but the fire dodges him and races up into the house. From there, it sweeps across an oriental rug, marches out to the back porch, leaps nimbly up onto a laundry line, and tightrope walks across to the house behind. It climbs in the window and pauses, as if shocked by its good fortune, because everything in this house is just made to burn too. The damask sofa with its long fringe, the mahogany end tables and chintz lampshades. The heat pulls down wallpaper and sheets. And this is happening not only in this apartment, but in 10 or 15 others, then 20 or 25, each house setting fire to its neighbor until entire blocks are burning. The smell of things burning that aren't meant to burn wafts across the city. Shoe polish, rat poison, toothpaste, piano strings, hernia trusses, baby cribs, Indian clubs, and hair and skin. By this time, hair and skin. On the quay, Lefty and Desdemona stand up along with everyone else, with people too stunned to react, or still half asleep, or sick with typhus and cholera, or exhausted beyond caring. And then suddenly, all the fires on the hillside form one great wall of fire stretching across the city, and it's inevitable now. Start moving down toward them. And now I remember something else. My father, Milton Stephanides, in robe and slippers, bending over to light a fire on Christmas morning. Only once a year did the need to dispose of a mountain of wrapping paper and cardboard packaging overrule Desdemona's objections to using our fireplace. "Ma," Milton would warn her, "I'm going to burn up some of this garbage now," to which Desdemona would cry, "Mana!" and grab her cane. At the hearth, my father would pull a long match from the hexagonal box, but Desdemona would already be moving away, heading for the safety of the kitchen, where the oven was electric. "Your yaya doesn't like fires," my father would tell us. And lighting the match, he would hold it to paper, covered with elves and Santas, as flames leapt up and we, ignorant American children, went crazy throwing paper boxes and ribbons into the blaze. Dr. Philibosian stepped out into the street, looked both ways, and ran straight across through the door opposite. He climbed to the landing, where he could see the top of Mrs. Bidzikian's head from behind as she sat in the living room. He ran to her, telling her not to worry. It was Dr. Philibosian from across the street. Mrs. Bidzikian seemed to nod, but her head didn't come back up. Dr. Philibosian knelt beside her, touching her neck. He felt a weak pulse. Gently, he pulled her out of the chair and laid her on the floor. As he did so, he heard footsteps on the stairway. He hurried across the room and hid behind the drapes just as the soldiers stormed in. For 15 minutes they ransacked the apartment, taking whatever the first band had left. They dumped out drawers and slid open sofas and clothing, looking for jewelry or money hidden inside. After they were gone, Dr. Philibosian waited a full 5 minutes before stepping out from behind the drapes. Mrs. Bitsikian's pulse had stopped. He spread his handkerchief over her face and made the sign of the cross over her body. Then he picked up his doctor's bag and hurried down the stairs again. The heat precedes the fire. Figs heaped along the quay, not loaded in time, begin to bake, bubbling and oozing juice. The sweetness mixes with the smell of smoke. Desdemona and Lefty stand as close to the water as possible along with everyone else. There's no escape. Turkish soldiers remain at the barricades. People pray, raise their arms, pleading to ships in the harbor. Searchlights sweep across the water, lighting up people swimming, drowning. "We're gonna die, Lefty." "No, we're not. We're gonna get out of here." But Lefty doesn't believe this. As he looks up at the flames, he is certain, too, that they are going to die. And this certainty inspires him to say something he would never have said otherwise, something he would never even have thought. "We're going to get out of here, and then you're going to marry me. We should never have left. We should have stayed in Vithinios. As the fire approaches, the doors of the French consulate open. A marine garrison forms two lines stretching across the quay to the harbor. The tricolor descends. From the consulate's doors, people emerge, men in cream-colored suits and women in straw hats walking arm in arm to a waiting launch. Over the Marines' crossed rifles, Lefty sees fresh powder on the women's faces, lit cigars in men's mouths. One woman holds a small poodle under her arm. Another woman trips, breaking her heel, and is consoled by her husband. After the launch has motored away, an official turns to the crowd.
French citizens only will be evacuated. We will begin processing visas immediately.
When they hear knocking, they jump. Stepan goes to the window and looks down.
It must be father.
Go, let him in, quick, Tuki says. Karakin vaults down the stairs two at a time. At the door, he stops, collects himself, and quietly unbolts the door. At first, when he pulls it open, he sees nothing. Then there's a soft hiss, followed by a ripping noise. The noise sounds as though it has nothing to do with him until suddenly a shirt button pops off and clatters against the door. Karakin looks down as all at once his mouth fills with a warm fluid. He feels himself being lifted off his feet, the sensation bringing back to him childhood memories of being whisked into the air by his father, and he says, "Dad, my button!" Before he is lifted high enough to make out the steel bayonet puncturing his sternum, the fire's reflection leads along the gun barrel, over the sight and hammer, to the soldier's ecstatic face. The fire bore down on the crowd at the quay. The roof of the American consulate caught. Flames climbed the movie theater, scorching the marquee. The crowd inched back from the heat, but Lefty, sensing his opportunity, was undeterred.
"Nobody will know," he said. "Who's to know? There's nobody left but us. It's not right."
Roofs crashed, people screamed as Lefty put his lips to his sister's ear. "You promised you'd find me a nice Greek girl? Well, you're it." On one side, a man jumped into the water trying to drown himself. On the other, a woman was giving birth as her husband shielded her with his coat.
"Que master, que master," people shouted. "We're burning, we're burning!"
Desdemona pointed at the fire, at everything. "It's too late, Lefty. It doesn't matter now."
"But if we lived, you'd marry me then?" A nod. That was all. And Lefty was gone, running toward the flames. On a black screen, a binocular-shaped template of vision sweeps back and forth, taking in the distant refugees. They scream without sound. They hold out their arms, beseeching.
"They're going to cook the poor wretches alive."
"Permission to retrieve a swimmer, sir."
"Negative, Phillips. Once we take one on board, we'll have to take them all."
"It's a girl, sir."
"How old?"
"Looks to be about 10 or 11.
Major Arthur Maxwell lowers his binoculars. A triangular knot of muscle tenses in his jaw and disappears.
"Have a look at her, sir."
"We mustn't be swayed by emotions, Herr Phillips. There are greater things at stake."
"Have a look at her, sir."
The wings of Major Maxwell's nose flare as he looks at Captain Phillips. Then, slapping one hand against his thigh, he moves to the side of the ship. The searchlight sweeps across the water, lighting up its own circle of vision. The water looks odd under the beam, a colorless broth littered with a variety of objects, a bright orange, a man's fedora with a brim of excrement, bits of paper like torn letters. And then, amid this inert matter, she appears, holding onto the ship's line, a girl in a pink dress, the water darkens to red, hair plastered to her small skull. Her eyes make no appeal staring up. Her sharp feet kick every so often, like fins. Rifle fire from shore hits the water around her. She pays no attention.
"Turn off the searchlight!"
The light goes off, and the firing stops. Major Maxwell looks at his watch.
"It is now 21:15 hours. I'm going to my cabin, Phillips. I will stay there until 0700 hours. Should a refugee be taken aboard during that period, it would not come to my attention. Is that understood?"
"Understood, sir."
It didn't occur to Dr. Philobosian that the twisted body he stepped over in the street belonged to his younger son. He noticed only that his front door was open. In the foyer, he stopped to listen. There was only silence. Slowly, still holding his doctor's bag, he climbed the stairs. All the lamps were on now. The living room was bright. Tuki was sitting on the sofa, waiting for him. Her head had fallen backward as though in hilarity, the angle opening the wound so that a section of windpipe gleamed. Stepan sat slumped at the dining table, his right hand, which held the letter of protection, nailed down with a steak knife. Dr. Philibosian took a step and slipped, then noticed a trail of blood leading down the hallway. He followed the trail into the master bedroom, where he found his two daughters. They were both naked, lying on their backs. Three of their four breasts had been cut off. Rose's hand reached out toward her sister as though to adjust the silver ribbon across her forehead. The line was long and moved slowly. Lefty had time to go over his vocabulary. He reviewed his grammar, taking quick peeks at the phrase book. He studied lesson one, greetings, and by the time he reached the official at the table, he was ready.
Name? Eleftherios Stefanidis. Place of birth? Paris.
The official looked up.
Passport? Everything was destroyed in the fire. I lost all my papers. Lefty puckered his lips and expelled air as he'd seen Frenchmen do. Well, look at what I'm wearing. I lost all my good suits. The official smiled wryly and stamped the papers.
Pass. I have my wife with me. I suppose she was born in Paris, too?
Of course. Her name?
Desdemona.
Desdemona Stefanidis.
That's right, same as mine. When he returned with the visas, Desdemona wasn't alone. A man sat beside her on the suitcase. He tried to throw himself in the water. I caught him just in time.
Dazed, bloody, a shining bandage wrapping one hand, the man kept repeating.
They couldn't read. They were illiterate.
Lefty checked to see where the man was bleeding, but couldn't find a wound. He unwrapped the man's bandage, a silver ribbon, and tossed it away.
They couldn't read my letter,
the man said, looking at Lefty, who recognized his face.
You again, the French official said.
My cousin, said Lefty, in execrable French.
The man stamped a visa and handed it to him.
A motor launch took them out to the ship. Lefty kept hold of Dr. Philibosian, who was still threatening to drown himself. Desdemona opened her silkworm box and unwrapped the white cloth to check on her eggs. In the hideous water, bodies floated past. Some were alive, calling out. A searchlight revealed a boy halfway up the anchor chain of a battleship. Sailors dumped oil on him, and he slipped back into the water. On the deck of the Jeanne Bar, the three new French citizens looked back at the burning city, ablaze from end to end. The fire would continue for the next 3 days, the flames visible for 50 miles. At sea, sailors would mistake the rising smoke for a gigantic mountain range. In the country they were heading for, America, the burning of Smyrna made the front pages for a day or two before being bumped off by the Hall Mills murder case. The body of Hall, a Protestant minister, had been found with that of Miss Mills, an attractive choir member, and the opening of the World Series. Admiral Mark Bristol of the U.S. Navy, concerned about damage to American-Turkish relations, cabled a press release in which he stated that it is impossible to estimate the number of deaths due to killings, fire, and execution, but the total probably does not exceed 2,000. The American consul, George Horton, had a larger estimate. Of the 400,000 Ottoman Christians in Smyrna before the fire, 190,000 were unaccounted for by October 1. Horton had that number and estimated the dead at 100,000. The anchors surged up out of the water. The deck rumbled underfoot as the destroyer's engines were thrown into reverse. Desdemona and Lefty watched Asia Minor recede. As they passed the Iron Duke, the British military service band started into a waltz. The Silk Road. According to an ancient Chinese legend, one day in the year 2640 BC, Princess Si Ling Qi was sitting under a mulberry tree when a silkworm cocoon fell into her teacup. When she tried to remove it, she noticed that the cocoon had begun to unravel in the hot liquid. She handed the loose end to her maidservant and told her to walk. The servant went out of the princess's chamber and into the palace courtyard and through the palace gates and out of the forbidden city and into the countryside a half mile away before the cocoon ran out. In the West, this legend would slowly mutate over three millennia until it became the story of a physicist and an apple. Either way, the meanings are the same. Great discoveries, whether of silk or of gravity, are always windfalls. They happen to people loafing under trees. I feel a little like that Chinese princess whose discovery gave Desdemona her livelihood. Like her, I unravel my story, and the longer the thread, the less there is left to tell. Retrace the filament, and you go back to the cocoon's beginning in a tiny knot, a first tentative loop, and following my story's thread back to where I left off, I see the Jean Bar dock in Athens. I see my grandparents on land again, making preparations for another voyage. Passports are placed into hands, vaccinations administered to upper arms. Another ship materializes at the dock, the Julia. A foghorn sounds, and look, from the deck of the Julia, something else unwinds now, something multicolored, spinning itself out over the waters of Piraeus. It was the custom in those days for passengers leaving for America to bring balls of yarn on deck. Relatives on the pier held the loose ends. As the Julia blew its horn and moved away from the dock, a few hundred strings of yarn stretched across the water. People shouted farewells, waved furiously, held up babies for last looks they wouldn't remember. Propellers churned, handkerchiefs fluttered, and up on deck, the balls of yarn began to spin, red, yellow, blue, green. They untangled toward the pier, slowly at first, one revolution every 10 seconds, then faster and faster as the boat picked up speed. Passengers held the yarn as long as possible, maintaining the connection to the faces disappearing on shore. But finally, one by one, the balls ran out. The strings of yarn flew free, rising on the breeze. From two separate locations on the Julia's deck, Lefty and Desdemona, and I can say it now finally, my grandparents watched the airy blanket float away. Desdemona was standing between two air manifolds, shaped like giant tubas. At midships, Lefty slouched in a brace of bachelors. In the last 3 hours, they hadn't seen each other. That morning, they'd had coffee together in a cafe near the harbor, after which, like professional spies, they'd picked up their separate suitcases, Desdemona keeping her silkworm box, and had departed in different directions. My grandmother was carrying falsified documents. Her passport, which the Greek government had granted under the condition that she leave the country immediately, bore her mother's maiden name Aristos instead of Stephanides. She'd presented this passport along with her boarding card at the top of the Julia's gangway. Then she'd gone aft, as planned, for the send-off. At the shipping channel, the foghorn sounded again as the boat came around to the west and picked up more speed. Dirndls, kerchiefs, and suit coats flapped in the breeze. A few hats flew off heads to shouts and laughter. Yarn drift-netted the sky, barely visible now. People watched as long as they could. Desdemona was one of the first to go below. Lefty lingered on deck for another half hour. This, too, was part of the plan. For the first day at sea, they didn't speak to each other. They came up on deck at the appointed meal times and stood in separate lines. After eating, Lefty joined the men smoking at the rail, while Desdemona hunched on deck with the women and children staying out of the wind.
"You have someone meeting you?" the woman asked. "A fiancé?" "No, just my cousin in Detroit."
"Traveling all by yourself?" the men asked Lefty.
"That's right, free and easy."
At night, they descended to their respective compartments, in separate bunks of seaweed wrapped in burlap, with life vests doubling as pillows. They tried to sleep, to get used to the motion of the ship, and to tolerate the smells. Passengers had brought on board all manner of spices and sweetmeats, tinned sardines, octopus and wine sauce, legs of lamb preserved with garlic cloves. In those days, you could identify a person's nationality by smell. Lying on her back with eyes closed, Desdemona could detect the telltale oniony aroma of a Hungarian woman on her right and the raw meat smell of an Armenian on her left. And they, in turn, could peg Desdemona as a Hellene by her aroma of garlic and yogurt. Lefty's annoyances were auditory as well as olfactory. To one side was a man named Callus, with a snore like a miniature foghorn itself. On the other was Dr. Philobosian, who wept in his sleep. Ever since leaving Smyrna, the doctor had been beside himself with grief. Racked, gut-socked, he lay curled up in his coat, blue around the eye sockets. He ate almost nothing. He refused to go up on deck to get fresh air. On the few occasions he did go, he threatened to throw himself overboard. In Athens, Dr. Philobosian had told them to leave him alone. He refused to discuss plans about the future and said that he had no family anywhere. "My family's gone. They murdered them." "Poor man," Desdemona said. "He doesn't want to live." "We have to help him," Lefty insisted. "He gave me money. He bandaged my hand. Nobody else cared about us. We'll take him with us." While they waited for their cousin to wire money, Lefty tried to console the doctor and finally convinced him to come with them to Detroit.
"Wherever's far away," said Dr. Philobosian.
But now on the boat, he talked only of death. The voyage was supposed to take from 12 to 14 days. Lefty and Desdemona had the schedule all worked out. On the second day at sea, directly after dinner, Lefty made a tour of the ship. He picked his way among the bodies sprawled across the steerage deck. He passed the stairway to the pilot house and squeezed past the extra cargo, crates of Kalmata olives and olive oil, sea sponges from Kos. He proceeded forward, running his hand along the green tarps of the lifeboats until he met the chain separating steerage from third class. In its heyday, the Julia had been part of the Austro-Hungarian line, boasting modern conveniences.
"Lumina electrica, ventilate e comforto, selme mare."
It had traveled once a month between Trieste and New York. Now, the electric lights worked only in first class, and even then sporadically. The iron rails were rusted, smoke from the stack had soiled the Greek flag. The boat smelled of old mop buckets and a history of nausea. Lefty didn't have his sea legs yet. He kept falling against the railing. He stood at the chain for an appropriate amount of time, then crossed to port and returned aft. Desdemona, as arranged, was standing alone at the rail. As Lefty passed, he smiled and nodded. She nodded coldly and looked back out to sea. On the third day, Lefty took another after-dinner stroll. He walked forward, crossed to port, and headed aft. He smiled at Desdemona and nodded again. This time Desdemona smiled back. Rejoining his fellow smokers, Lefty inquired if any of them might happen to know the name of that young woman traveling alone. On the fourth day out, Lefty stopped and introduced himself.
"So far the weather's been good."
"I hope it stays that way."
"You're traveling alone?"
"Yes."
"I am too. Where are you going to in America?"
"Detroit."
"What a coincidence."
"I'm going to Detroit too."
They stood chatting for another few minutes. Then Desdemona excused herself and went down below.
Rumors of the budding romance spread quickly through the ship. To pass the time, everybody was soon discussing how the tall young Greek with the elegant bearing had become enamored of the dark beauty who was never seen anywhere without her carved olive wood box. They're both traveling alone, people said, and they both have relatives in Detroit. I don't think they're right for each other.
Why not?
He's a higher class than she is. It'll never work.
He seems to like her, though.
He's on a boat in the middle of the ocean. What else does he have to do? On the fifth day, Lefty and Desdemona took a stroll on deck together. On the sixth day, he presented his arm, and she took it.
I introduced them, one man boasted.
City girls sniffed. She wears her hair in braids. She looks like a peasant. My grandfather, on the whole, came in for better treatment. He was said to have been a silk merchant from Smyrna who'd lost his fortune in the fire, a son of King Constantine I by a French mistress, a spy for the Kaiser during the Great War. Lefty never discouraged any speculation. He seized the opportunity of transatlantic travel to reinvent himself. He wrapped a ratty blanket over his shoulders like an opera cape, aware that whatever happened now would become the truth, that whatever he seemed to be would become what he was. Already an American, in other words. He waited for Desdemona to come up on deck. When she did, he adjusted his wrap, nodded to his shipmates, and sauntered across the deck to pay his respects.
He's smitten.
I don't think so. Type like that? He's just out for a little fun. That girl better watch it, or she'll have more than that box to carry around. My grandparents enjoyed their simulated courtship. When people were within earshot, they engaged in first or second date conversations, making up past histories for themselves. So, Lefty would ask, do you have any siblings?
Oh, I had a brother, Desdemona replied wistfully. He ran off with a Turkish girl. My father disowned him.
That's very strict. I think love breaks all taboos. Don't you?
Alone, they told each other, I think it's working. No one suspects. Each time Lefty encountered Desdemona on deck, he pretended he'd only recently met her. He walked up, made small talk, commented on the beauty of the sunset, and then, gallantly, segued into the beauty of her face. Desdemona played her part, too. She was standoffish at first. She withdrew her arm whenever he made an off-color joke. She told him that her mother had warned her about men like him. They passed the voyage playing out this imaginary flirtation, and little by little, they began to believe it. They fabricated memories, improvised fate. Why did they do it? Why did they go to all that trouble? Couldn't they have said they were already engaged or that their marriage had been arranged years earlier? Yes, of course they could have. But it wasn't the other travelers they were trying to fool. It was themselves. Traveling made it easier. Sailing across the ocean among 500,000 perfect strangers conveyed an anonymity in which my grandparents could recreate themselves. The driving spirit on the Julia was self-transformation. Staring out to sea, tobacco farmers imagined themselves as race car drivers, silk dyers, as Wall Street tycoons, millinery girls, as fan dancers in the Ziegfeld Follies. Gray ocean stretched in all directions. Europe and Asia Minor were dead behind them. Ahead lay America and new horizons. On the eighth day at sea, Lefty Stefanides, grandly, on one knee, in full view of 663 steerage passengers, proposed to Desdemona Aristos while she sat on a docking cleat. Young women held their breath. Married men nudged bachelors.
Pay attention and you'll learn something.
My grandmother, displaying a theatrical flair akin to her hypochondria, registered complex emotions. Surprise, initial delight, second thoughts, prudent near refusal, and then to the applause already starting up. Dizzy acceptance. The ceremony took place on deck. In lieu of a wedding dress, Desdemona wore a borrowed silk shawl over her head. Captain Contulis loaned Lefty a necktie spotted with gravy stains.
"Keep your coat buttoned and nobody will notice," he said.
For Stefana, my grandparents had wedding crowns woven with rope. Flowers weren't available at sea, and so the cumbaros, a guy named Pelos, serving as best man, switched the king's hempen crown to the queen's head, the queen's to the king's, and back again. Bride and bridegroom performed the dance of Isaiah, hip to hip, arms interwoven to hold hands. Desdemona and Lefty circumambulated the captain, once, twice, and then again, spinning the cocoon of their life together. No patriarchal linearity here. We Greeks get married in circles to impress upon ourselves the essential matrimonial facts that to be happy, you have to find variety in repetition, that to go forward, you have to come back where you began. Or, in my grandparents' case, the circling worked like this. As they paced around the deck the first time, Lefty and Desdemona were still brother and sister. The second time, they were bride and bridegroom. And the third, they were husband and wife. The night of my grandparents' wedding, the sun set directly before the ship's bow, pointing the way to New York. The moon rose, casting a silver stripe over the ocean. On his nightly tour of the deck, Captain Contulis descended from the pilot house and marched forward. The wind had picked up. The Julia pitched in high seas. As the deck tilted back and forth, Captain Contulis didn't stumble once and was even able to light one of the Indonesian cigarettes he favored, dipping his cap's braided brim to cut the wind. In his not terribly clean uniform, wearing knee-high Cretan boots, Captain Contulis scrutinized running lights, stacked deck chairs, lifeboats. The Julia was alone on the vast Atlantic, hatches battened down against swells crashing over the side. The decks were empty except for two first-class passengers, American businessmen sharing a nightcap under lap blankets.
"From what I hear, Tilden doesn't just play tennis with his protégés, if you get my drift. You're kidding. Let's them drink from the loving cup."
Captain Contulis, understanding none of this, nodded as he passed. Inside one of the lifeboats, Desdemona was saying, "Don't look." She was lying on her back. There was no goat's hair blanket between them, so Lefty covered his eyes with his hands peeking through his fingers. A single pinhole in the tarp leaked moonlight, which slowly filled the lifeboat. Lefty had seen Desdemona undress many times, but usually as no more than a shadow and never in moonlight. She had never curled onto her back like this, lifting her feet to take off her shoes. He watched as she pulled down her skirt and lifted her tunic, was struck by how different his sister looked in moonlight, in a lifeboat. She glowed. She gave off white light. He blinked behind his hands. The moonlight kept rising. It covered his neck. It reached his eyes until he understood. Desdemona was wearing a corset. That was the other thing she'd brought along. The white cloth enfolding her silkworm eggs was nothing other than Desdemona's wedding corset. She thought she'd never wear it. But here it was. Brassiere cups pointed up at the canvas roof. Whalebone slats squeezed her waist. The corset skirt dropped garters attached to nothing because my grandmother owned no stockings. In the lifeboat, the corset absorbed all available moonlight, with the odd result that Desdemona's face, head, and arms disappeared. She looked like winged victory, tumbled on her back, being carted off to a conqueror's museum. All that was missing was the wings. Lefty took off his shoes and socks as grit rained down. When he removed his underwear, the lifeboat filled with a mushroomy smell. He was ashamed momentarily, but Desdemona didn't seem to mind. She was distracted by her own mixed feelings. The corset, of course, reminded Desdemona of her mother, and suddenly the wrongness of what they were doing assailed her. Until now, she had been keeping it at bay. She had had no time to dwell on it in the chaos of the last days. Lefty, too, was conflicted. Though he had been tortured by thoughts of Desdemona, he was glad for the darkness of the lifeboat, glad in particular that he couldn't see her face. For months, Lefty had slept with whores who resembled Desdemona, but now he found it easier to pretend that she was a stranger. The corset seemed to possess its own sets of hands. One was softly rubbing her between the legs, two more cupped her breasts, one, two, three hands pressing and caressing her, and in the lingerie Desdemona saw herself through no eyes, her thin waist, her plump thighs. She felt beautiful, desirable, most of all, not herself. She lifted her feet, rested her calves on the oarlocks. She spread her legs. She opened her arms for Lefty, who twisted around, chafing his knees and elbows, dislodging oars, nearly setting off a flare, until finally he fell into her softness, swooning. For the first time, Desdemona tasted the flavor of his mouth. And the only sisterly thing she did during their lovemaking was to come up for air once to say, "Bad boy, you've done this before." But Lefty only kept repeating, "Not like this, not like this." And I was wrong before. I take it back. Underneath Desdemona, beating time against the boards and lifting her up, a pair of wings. "Lefty," Desdemona now breathlessly, "I think I felt it." "Felt what?" "You know, that feeling."
"Newlyweds," Captain Contulus said, watching the lifeboat rock. "Oh, to be young again."
After Princess Sealing Chi, whom I find myself picturing as the imperial version of the bicyclist I saw in the U-Bahn the other day, I can't stop thinking about her for some reason. I keep looking for her every morning. After Princess Sealing Chi discovered silk, her nation kept it a secret for 3,190 years. Anyone who attempted to smuggle silkworm eggs out of China faced punishment of death. My family might never have become silk farmers if it hadn't been for the Emperor Justinian, who, according to Procopius, persuaded two missionaries to risk it. In A.D. 550, the missionaries snuck silkworm eggs out of China in the swallowed condom of the time, a hollow staff. They also brought the seeds of the mulberry tree. As a result, Byzantium became a center for sericulture. Mulberry trees flourished on Turkish hillsides. Silkworms ate the leaves. 1,400 years later, the descendants of those first stolen eggs filled my grandmother's silkworm box on the Julia. I'm the descendant of a smuggling operation, too. Without their knowing, my grandparents, on their way to America, were each carrying a single mutated gene on the fifth chromosome. It wasn't a recent mutation. According to Dr. Luce, the gene first appeared in my bloodline sometime around 1750 in the body of one Penelope Evangelatos, my great-grandmother to the ninth power. She passed it on to her son Petras, who passed it on to his two daughters, who passed it on to three of their five children, and so on and so on. Being recessive, its expression would have been fitful. Sporadic heredity is what the geneticists call it, a trait that goes underground for decades only to reappear when everyone's forgotten about it. That was how it went in Vithynios. Every so often, a hermaphrodite was born, a seeming girl who, in growing up, proved otherwise. For the next 6 nights, under various meteorological conditions, my grandparents trysted in the lifeboat. Desdemona's guilt flared up during the day, when she sat on deck wondering if she and Lefty were to blame for everything, but by nighttime she felt lonely and wanted to escape the cabin, and so stole back to the lifeboat and her new husband. Their honeymoon proceeded in reverse. Instead of getting to know each other, becoming familiar with likes and dislikes, ticklish spots, pet peeves, Desdemona and Lefty tried to defamiliarize themselves with each other. In the spirit of their shipboard con game, they continued to spin out false histories for themselves, inventing brothers and sisters with plausible names, cousins with moral shortcomings, in-laws with facial tics.
They took turns reciting Homeric genealogies, full of falsifications and borrowings from real life, and sometimes they fought over this or that favorite real uncle or aunt, and had to bargain like casting directors. Gradually, as the nights passed, these fictional relatives began to crystallize in their minds. They'd quiz each other on obscure connections, Lefty asking, "Who's your second cousin Giannis married to?" And Desdemona replying, "Oh, that's easy, Athena, with the limp." And am I wrong to think that my obsession with family relations started right there in the lifeboat? Didn't my mother quiz me on uncles and aunts and cousins, too? She never quizzed my brother, because he was in charge of snow shovels and tractors, whereas I was supposed to provide the feminine glue that keeps families together, writing thank you notes and remembering everybody's birthdays and name days. Listen, I've heard the following genealogy come out of my mother's mouth. "That's your cousin Malia. She's Uncle Mike's sister, Lucille's brother-in-law, Stathis's daughter. You know Stathis, the mailman who's not too swift. Malia's his third child after his boys, Mike and Johnny. You should know her. Malia, she's your cousin-in-law by marriage." And here I am now, sketching it all out for you, dutifully oozing feminine glue, but also with a dull pain in my chest, because I realize that genealogies tell you nothing. Tessie knew who was related to whom, but she had no idea who her own husband was or what her in-laws were to each other. The whole thing, a fiction, created in the lifeboat where my grandparents made up their lives. Sexually, things were simple for them. Dr. Peter Luce, the great sexologist, can cite astonishing statistics asserting that oral sex didn't exist between married couples prior to 1950. My grandparents' lovemaking was pleasurable but unvarying. Every night, Desdemona would disrobe down to her corset, and Lefty would press its clasps and hooks, searching for the secret combination that sprung the locked garment open. The corset was all they needed in terms of an aphrodisiac, and it remained for my grandfather the singular erotic emblem of his life. The corset made Desdemona new again. As I said, Lefty had glimpsed his sister naked before, but the corset had the odd power of making her seem somehow more naked. It turned her into a forbidding, armored creature with a soft inside he had to hunt for. When the tumblers clicked, it popped open. Lefty crawled on top of Desdemona, and the two of them hardly even moved. The ocean swells did the work for them. Their perifescence existed simultaneously with a less passionate stage of pair bonding. Sex could give way at any moment to coziness. So after making love, they lay staring up through the pulled-back tarp at the night sky passing overhead, and got down to the business of life. "Maybe Lena's husband can give me a job," Lefty said. "He's got his own business, right?"
"I don't know what he does. Lena never gives me a straight answer.
After we save some money, I can open a casino. Some gambling, a bar, maybe a floor show, and potted palms everywhere. You should go to college. Become a professor like mother and father wanted. And we have to build a cocoonery, remember? Oh, forget the silkworms. I'm talking roulette, rabitica, drinking, dancing. Maybe I'll sell some hash on the side. They won't let you smoke hashish in America."
"Who says?"
And Desdemona announced with certitude,
"It's not that kind of country." They spent what remained of their honeymoon on deck, learning how to finagle their way through Ellis Island. It wasn't so easy anymore. The Immigration Restriction League had been formed in 1894. On the floor of the U.S. Senate, Henry Cabot Lodge thumped a copy of On the Origin of Species, warning that the influx of inferior peoples from Southern and Eastern Europe threatened the very fabric of our race. The Immigration Act of 1917 barred 33 kinds of undesirables from entering the United States. And so, in 1922, on the deck of the Julia, passengers discussed how to escape the categories. In nervous cram sessions, illiterates learned to pretend to read, bigamists to admit to only one wife, anarchists to deny having read Proudhon. heart patients to simulate vigor, epileptics to deny their fits, and carriers of hereditary diseases to neglect mentioning them. My grandparents, unaware of their genetic mutation, concentrated on the more blatant disqualifications. Another category of restriction, persons convicted of a crime or misdemeanor involving moral turpitude, and a subset of this group, incestuous relations. They avoided passengers who seemed to be suffering from trachoma or phavus. They fled anyone with a hacking cough. Occasionally, for reassurance, Lefty took out the certificate that declared Eleftherios Stephanides